This is KCPX Central Coast Public Radio. It's time for Issues and Ideas, a show that features a wide variety of local voices sharing their thoughts and perspectives. Coming up, poet Diane Sousa talks about poetry with me, Meher Ali, on my segment, The Lonely Goat Cafe.
How I think about my poetry is that life wants a report. So this is my report back to life.
Then, reporter Benjamin Perper finds out how musician Brooke Monroe incorporates winemaking into his compositions.
It's a wild concept, turning wine into music, but to me, it felt like it had to be done because I don't know many composers who are also full-time in the wine industry.
These stories and more coming up on Issues and Ideas. Good afternoon. It's Monday, July 28th, 2025. I'm Meher Ali. Let's start with Father Ian's Playing with Food.
Would you eat algae? Would you use it as an ingredient in your daily cooking? It might sound disgusting, but you have probably already eaten algae the last time you were in a Japanese restaurant. There are four types of edible algae: seaweed, like nori and wakame, sea moss, chlorella, a single-celled green algae that lives in freshwater, and spirulina, a blue-green algae that can be digested by the human body in its whole form. Spirulina has been a food source for millennia. It's been a popular supplement in the U.S. for decades, and it's being produced right here on the Central Coast. So the Playing with Food team trekked to Southern Slo County to discover this treat.
My name is Dale Solomon, and I'm an algae farmer. This is Oasia Farms. This is spirulina, also known as Arthrospira platensis, and it is a blue-green algae. Spirulina is an amazing health food. It's a complete food, which means you could eat nothing but spirulina and get all of the protein, carbohydrates, healthy fats, omega-3s, vitamins, everything that your body needs, and it would be enough for you to subsist on. We're here at Greenhouse One, and this is our brand new beautiful culture that we're scaling up. This is our new pond. We're basically scaling this up, getting it ready so that we can eventually harvest it. If you scoop in a little handful here, you'll see it's a microscopic organism. So this, can you kind of see those little grains of sand there?
Yeah.
So that's the spirulina. And what we're going to be doing when we harvest is actually filtering out those teeny tiny little specks, and eventually it'll form a mat of spirulina. It'll look like green yogurt almost. We take that product, we press it, we cool it, we package it, and that is the final product that we consume on Harvestly and Farmer's Market.
We're in a polytunnel, basically, and there's this pool that runs the length of it, and it looks like a lap pool, and the paddle wheel is keeping it moving, but at the other end that we can't get to, it looks like it's open, so it looks like a down and return kind of thing.
That's right. It's a giant loop or an oval shape that just goes back and forth, around and around. There's a center wall in the middle dividing it, but it's just a giant racetrack type shape where the water can flow around and around in a circle.
Where does the algae originally come from?
Spirulina, originally it's from Lake Chad in Central Africa, and there's also a strain from Lake Texcoco in Mexico. One is called Spirulina platensis, and I believe the other one is Spirulina maxima, if I have that correct. Usually, commercial farms grow the Spirulina platensis. The Kanembu tribe in Central Africa would cultivate this. Eventually, the Western world found out about it, and we've been commercially growing spirulina since the 70s.
Oh, okay, so this isn't a new thing.
No, it's not. No, it's very old. The Aztecs grew it on Lake Texcoco hundreds and hundreds of years ago. So native peoples have been growing spirulina, but it became commercially available around the 70s.
There are four other lap pools that are empty. How are you going to start this lap pool here?
This one will continue to grow denser and have more and more spirulina cells. Well, then we'll dilute it to keep it around the same density with more water and nutrients. We have a specific formula of water and fertilizer nutrients that we add. And it'll, again, get more dense and need more space. So then we'll pump half this pond into the other one and, again, start adding more water and nutrients, what we call a dilution process. So it's growing and growing and filling out this new home, this extra water, and it'll continue doing that until it ends up in our biggest pond over in the other greenhouse. And it would go like that, adding water and nutrients until all the ponds are full, the entire farm is fully functional. Then we begin the harvest process. We have these pumps here, and we can electronically control this pump from inside of our processing area. So we can speed up and slow the pump down exactly how we want it. So if the harvest is flowing really well, the cells are filtering, we can run that pump faster and get more pounds per hour. if we want to slow it down a little bit, or if the culture is very dense and we just don't need to pump as much, we can slow that pump down. And these pipes bring it into and then return the filtered media back out to the pond. So we're recycling that media. And every single day, we're just trimming back the pond, harvesting it, and pumping that plain water and fertilizer mix without the spirulina back to the pond.
Is this kind of like a sourdough starter where you bought an original jar of spirulina and then just grew it and...
And you're always adding more sourdough and letting it grow out. That's exactly right. It's a culture. And in that case, the culture medium, or the thing that it's growing in, the culture's house, is the bread dough. In this case, it's water. What we call culture medium is water and fertilizer that it grows in. It's constantly getting a new house. Even when we've got it up to scale, when we have the entire farm full, every week or two, we're taking some of that culture and we're throwing it away and adding fresh new water, fresh new nutrients. Just like you have an aquarium that's always getting filtered, that's what we're doing here, is we're always refreshing, cleaning, adding new nutrients into that pond.
The next part in terms of the harvest, so when you're pumping it out of one of the ponds, you're filtering out the spirulina and you're putting the water and nutrients back into the pond in order to be used again.
That's exactly right. Instead of billions and billions of tiny little algae cells, imagine if it's a gigantic aquarium and you have sardines in there. And every day you're going to take maybe 10 sardines out, and then 10 new little sardine babies are going to start growing. Then you take 10 more out the next day. And you're always putting that water back in without the sardines, but then the next day you'll remove another 10 sardines and put the water back empty. We're basically always matching the growth of that pond and keeping it at a relatively similar density so that the next day we're able to come back and get another 10%, just shave off a little bit.
You've been to the Monterey Bay Aquarium, haven't you?
You can tell. Yes, I have.
Yeah, that's like my favorite exhibition at the aquarium is that there's two of them, aren't there? There's one that's the entryway to the big window.
And it's giant. Yeah.
And then the other one is its own little cylinder with the sardines in it. How long does it take to grow from when you first fill a pond to when you start to harvest it?
It depends on what you're starting with, of course. If you're starting with a liter or a tiny little bit to get to the point where you're at a 90,000 liter pond, it's going to take about a month and a half, maybe 2 months, 2.5 months, depending on the temperature and the growth conditions. What we're looking at here is this pond, which is still relatively small. We're going to get the entire farm full within about a week and a half just from this culture. So that's the beauty of this type of thing, is it's growing exponentially. It's doubling every 2 to 3 days. And in the next 2 to 3 days, it's double that. So 2, 4, 8, 16 times, and you can expand very, very rapidly that way.
Is this the only pond that has anything in it right now?
No, there's another one. It's an older culture that we're getting ready to dump out.
Oh, wow.
It's big, yeah.
Wow. And it's so, quite warm in here as well.
It's toasty. Yeah, it's real toasty. You want me to turn the fan on? Part of the beauty of this farm is that it's highly automated. And I've really leaned into that automation and technology, because as a small business, there's very little margin for error and there's very little profit margin. So you have to, as I say, work smarter, not harder. We've got this really wonderful system that automates the temperature of our pond. So from my phone, I just turned on the fans here. As you can see, the vents here open up. There's a little time delay relay. The fan down there will click on. There we go.
Ooh, I feel it already. Wow.
Yeah.
Okay, so this is enormous. And you said you're about ready to dump this?
We're going
to
dump this out. Yeah, we're going to harvest what's left in it and get rid of the culture. It's been operating for about 3 months now. We've done some smaller dilutions in the meantime. So we'll take maybe 15% of the pond every couple weeks, throw it out and put in fresh water. But it just needs to get cleaned. As you can see, there's some algae that's formed on the ring as a ring around the pond. And we just got to get in there, clean all that out. And then we spray it down with vinegar at the end. That helps to sterilize the pond.
Okay, so how long does the culture last then?
About 3 months, three and a half months. And then we'll dump it, start over from the beginning. Because the pond is operating at high pH, you can get a lot of water hardness that sort of falls out of solution. So you see this on your shower head, right? That kind of scaly looking stuff. And that can form at the bottom of the pond. And that can be a problem because it's now a house for bacteria. So we're always fighting back that mud, trying to get rid of it, trying to get that, we call it mud, but it's just calcium, and remove it, because we don't want a scaffolding or a house for bacteria to form at the bottom of the ponds.
When you say you're gonna dump this 90,000 liters, where does it go?
It goes outside to our evaporation pond. And right now that's basically just a holding tank. What we're working on in the future is to be able to use the nutrients that are in there. It's a little bit dirty, it's not good enough for food grade use, but we can use those nutrients to grow spirulina for fertilizer. So we're hoping to open up a new fertilizer line, and that spirulina that's produced from that would be organic fertilizer. It's a soil amendment, it's full of all sorts of omega-3s, which are good for strawberries, and we can also use that in soil to improve the microbial health of the soil. So it's a really wonderful fertilizer soil amendment. Hopefully we can have it be clean or just a little bit salty water by the end of that process, bringing us full circle and having a closed loop system where we're not producing waste. Let's go inside.
You're listening to KCBX Public Radio for the Central Coast. I'm Father Ian, and I'm at Oasia Farms learning about the production of the blue-green algae, spirulina, as a food source. Dale just gave me a tour of the ponds. As simple as the ponds are, they are hard to visualize, so pop over to the podcast on the KCBX website later today and have a look at the photos. We've now gone inside to see what happens once spirulina is harvested and to have a taste.
So, well, this is fun. Are we going to be able to see something coming out of the press?
Yes, last batch.
So you saw those pipes from outside that are going into the pond. You saw the pump, and then it pumps that spirulina inside of the shipping container office that we have here. Then it comes down here. There's a filter, 300 micron stainless steel filter that removes any debris if there's a bug that got into the pond or a leaf that fell in there. It's an enclosed environment, but you still, just from opening a door, you might get an occasional fly or something that gets in there. So we're filtering all that. And then it's coming down here through this pipe. Normally this cylinder here is going to be covered in a filter material.
So what are you doing here?
Right here is the biomass, the final product of what comes out of the harvester. Actually, what comes out of the vacuum press. When coming out of the harvester, it's more of a wetter, thicker biomass. And we set it up inside this filter right here, and it's a vacuum press. So we suck out all the culture medium that's inside the product, and here we have the final product.
You brave enough to try a little bit?
Sure. Okay, you want to try some?
It's dry. Pretty flavor neutral.
I was thinking the exact same thing. Pretty flavor neutral.
So that's surprising to a lot of people who know spirulina because they're used to the powder.
It's kind of got a texture between, I don't know, Wonder Bread and a yoga mat. I mean, it looks like a yoga mat, actually. It looks like a dark green yoga mat,
yeah,
right? When he's
good.
Working with it, and I'm like, but then he gave me a taste, and it was a completely different texture than
you were expecting.
Than I was expecting, yeah. I can't even describe it. It's kind of like, it's like cookie dough when you've only put half the flour in it.
Yeah, or maybe like a pistachio butter. I always get that kind of like a light, nutty flavor. It's meant to be very mild. What we're doing here is we're trying to show people that spirulina doesn't have to be a weird, yucky powder supplement. It's a fresh food. You can put it in your salad. You can put it in a smoothie. You can use it just like you would use an avocado. Put it on toast. Have fun with it. You know, make a little dip and have some crackers with it. Just incorporate it into your diet and use it like you would other veggies. It doesn't have to be a supplement, and it definitely doesn't have to be smelly.
You have it in a plastic tub now. How much is that?
Right here we have 3,826 grams.
Okay.
And I'm going to separate it in another container so I can properly place it inside an ice bath so it can get down the temperature and we can pack it.
And you're going to pack it just like that?
In this form, yes.
Yeah, correct.
Right.
Once you package it, you're packaging it for sale.
We do have a number of different packaging solutions. So for some of our customers, they're getting it wholesale, and they're going to want to take it and put it in their own packaging. Maybe they're using it as an ingredient in, say, a juice. And then we also have our own products that are going into, say, a jar that's being sold at Harvestly or at Farmer's Market. We have a frozen product line. So there's a number of different ways that we package this. But this is the main ingredient in all of them. The only one that's not pure spirulina is sometimes when we're freezing it, we do have to add a little water to get it to flow into either our mold or through our packaging machine. But it's all just spirulina here.
I missed the harvest, and you said this is the last press. Was that from this morning's harvest?
Yes, this is from this morning's harvest.
Okay, and that's 3.8 kilograms or 8 pounds. How much did you get from the harvest this morning?
Today's goal was actually 40 pounds.
What are some of the issues that you can have with growing spirulina?
Some of the issues with growing spirulina are managing the genome of the spirulina. So if you think about harvesting a product like this, it's basically the opposite of Darwinism, which is that the fittest survive, right? The best, the biggest, the strongest animals and plants, those are the ones that go on to live. Well, that's the opposite here. The ones that are the biggest, most robust, best cells, those are the ones that are getting harvested. And if there's a weak, scrawny little cell, it might just slip right through the filter. And over time, what you find is that the culture gets more and more difficult to harvest because of those one or two cells every single time slipping through. And those are the ones that go to repopulate in the pond. So we're always looking for a new culture to scale up every few months and repopulate the pond. If we didn't do that, our job would quickly become insufferable. It would become very, very difficult.
Where do you get your new culture?
There's a company down in San Diego. They go in with a microscope and they'll actually identify one or two single cells that they like. They'll isolate them and scale that up. And that kind of lab work is just not something that we don't have the equipment and the manpower to do that. But we get our new culture from them, and it's always worked fantastic.
You said the different types of products. What is like the distribution of Oasia?
I would say that it's probably about 75% wholesale, maybe even more. We do have a small amount of online sales, so that's something we're actually looking to grow. And we can ship currently all throughout the U.S., all 50 states. That's something that I'm hoping to grow in time. I've been spending most of my time for the last 8 years just focusing on making the farm the best that it can be, being very efficient, automating all those things. But now we've got a little extra time on our hands, and I'd like to expand into the direct-to-consumer world, which is online sales.
Who's buying it wholesale, and what are they doing with it?
There's folks that are using it as an ingredient, and there's also folks that take it, and then they'll ship it out. They've got individuals, either stores that are selling it on the shelf, using it as an ingredient in their products that they make, or folks that are going back out and selling it as just a plain old product, just plain spirulina, and they've been doing a lot of those online sales.
How long have you been doing this?
About 8 years now.
What got you interested in this?
So originally I found out about the algae world when I was in college. I was in an environmental club, and I just found it fascinating. There's someone that presented about algae as a fuel source, biofuels. And I looked into that. It didn't seem like there weren't any companies that were doing it successfully. Not that the technology doesn't exist, but that they weren't able to compete with fossil fuels economically. And so the business model failed. But I still thought that there was a really great opportunity in the industry to fight climate change, to reduce emissions, find a more sustainable way to do things. It ended up being in the agriculture industry, not in the energy industry. In agriculture, we use diesel tractors and trucks. We have large pieces of equipment, and we also are damaging the land. We're creating dead zones in the ocean, which become these giant sources of methane. The agriculture industry, in many ways, direct and indirect, contributes to climate change. And I thought that switching over to a very sustainable crop like this and proving that it's successful would go a long way to helping address that. But no one wants to have something that's more expensive and worse than the alternative. We need to show people this is delicious. It's so much better than powder. It's good for you. It's great for the planet. And right now, it is a premium product. But as we grow and scale, my dream is to make this affordable to anyone and have it be on shelves and grocery stores all over the country. I know we can do that if the company can grow big enough and have economies of scale.
This is KCBX Public Radio for the Central Coast. I'm Father Ian, and I'm on a spirulina farm learning about the benefits of spirulina as a food source. We've seen the ponds. We've seen the final product. We've tasted it. Let's find out what you can do with it.
So you're going to actually get an exciting look into one of our newest products. This is our pods. Remember I mentioned to you earlier that there's certain products that we add water to. This is one of them. We get it to flow through this machine that you see here. It's got a hopper on top and uses a pneumatic piston to push the spirulina into a little single serving packet. And the exciting thing about this is that we took it and we froze it with liquid nitrogen. So when you flash freeze something, the ice crystals that form are very, very tiny, and it does significantly less damage to the cell structure of the thing that you're freezing. It's more expensive, but when you have a premium product like this, it just makes such a big difference in the quality. When I thawed this out for the first time and tried it, I thought this is so creamy and flavor neutral. It almost tastes like ice cream, but without any flavor, like if you just made whole milk into ice cream. It was delicious. I fell in love with it. We're looking at ways to use liquid nitrogen at scale, not just on an experimental level. Anyway, I'm going to give you this
okay. So
you could try it and see what it's like. You can eat it like a popsicle.
Okay.
And it's so good for you, and it's delicious too.
Okay, cool.
Yeah.
And do you have any labeled products that I could take a picture of?
Sure. Yeah. I don't know if we've made the jars yet.
Is that an indication that you're not warehousing anything? You process it, you package it, it goes out.
This is as fresh as it gets.
Okay.
It's going out the same day. Yeah. Okay. And if you're in Los Angeles, if you're anywhere in Southern California, you're getting that product the next day. So talk about farm fresh. It's being harvested, say, if it's a Tuesday morning around 5 a.m., it's being sent down to temperature and packaged by 12, dropped off to FedEx, and then delivered to your house the next day, sometimes as early as 10 or 11 a.m. So it's a very fresh product, and it's a short shelf life product, so we want to keep it that way so that people can use it within about a week and a half.
So you said you have recipes on your website?
We do, yeah. You can find, I think it's about a dozen different recipes. You can put it in avocado toast. You can put it on a salad dressing. You can put it in a yogurt bowl. It's great in the morning. It's got a lot of protein, and it's very filling. I've had a lot of customers tell me that it gives them energy and helps them fight craving for snacks and things like that throughout the morning. A lot of the recipes are centered around that. But you can also use it in a dinner dish as well. There's a lovely cilantro salad dressing. My girlfriend makes that. It's probably my favorite thing that we make with spirulina. And also coconut. Is delicious. Coconut water with spirulina is fantastic.
Okay, I'll look into some of those recipes to see what I can do with this.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I don't know that that'll make it home, but you could try. I would probably recommend eating that today.
Okay.
Whenever I meet with people, they always have four questions. How do I use it? How long does it last? What's the price? And how much do I take?
I did have that question, like, what is the limit and are there any side effects? I did a show on all things fermented. There's this coconut yogurt and it comes in pint jars. I took a scoop after I tasted it was when he was telling me you only need like a tablespoon a day. If you ate a whole jar of this, you'd probably be on the toilet all day. And I was like, well, I'm glad you told me before I had any more.
There shouldn't be any side effects. I mean, I guess with anything, you could drink too much water and that could kill you. So like, it does have a lot of protein. I wouldn't go eating pounds and pounds of it in a day.
Okay.
That might be a little too much for your kidneys. But no, it's a food just like any other. So if you like kale, if you like avocados, go ahead and eat a bunch of them, you know? If you like spirulina and you're enjoying the health benefits of it, if you can feel the difference in your body, there's no reason why you can't have 4, 5, 6 tablespoons in a day. Although generally we recommend anywhere from a teaspoon to a tablespoon to start. That's enough where you'll feel the health benefits of it.
Okay, that's good to know.
There's a company that uses our product called Mingle-licious, something like that on Instagram. And they make this product, I'm pretty sure it's the coconut meat and the coconut water, and they puree it. So it has this really nice thick, like a smoothie kind of consistency. Delicious. I think they're Thailand coconuts, so they have a little sweetness to them. And then they mix the spirulina in. I think they kind of like twirl the spoon as they're putting it in. So it gets this like beautiful marbled, deep green and white color. It's the most delicious, beautiful looking product. If you guys are in Santa Barbara or Ventura area, they're in farmers markets all throughout there. They kind of turned me on to the coconut spirulina mix.
What a fascinating farm right here on the Central Coast. I took my little sachet of spirulina home and I did what Dale suggested. I added it to foods. I made guacamole and just squirted about a teaspoon of spirulina into it. I've never seen such green guacamole. If you check out the photos on the podcast site, you'll understand what I mean. I topped some fruit with it as well. Because it's flavor neutral, it didn't really change the flavor. I knew, though, that I was adding protein and nutrients to my diet. I didn't have enough over a long enough period of time to notice a change in my health, but it definitely was a positive experience. If you're looking for a food that has everything you've ever wanted, well, except dairy fat, then check out spirulina. A clinical study that is posted to the National Library of Medicine clearly sets it on the opposite side of the spectrum to those health supplements that you get at the dollar store. The research article by Karkos, Long, Karkos, Sijavi, and Asimakopoulos states, spirulina refers to the dried biomass of Arthrospira plantensis, an oxygenic photosynthetic bacterium found worldwide in fresh and marine waters. This alga represents an important staple diet in humans and has been used as a source of protein and vitamin supplement in humans without any significant side effects. Some highlights are that it can have up to 70% protein, and many toxicological studies have proven it safe. But the most exciting aspect of spirulina is not in the pond or in the paper. It's in the heavens. The abstract to the paper begins with, spirulina is a blue-green alga that became famous after it was successfully used by NASA as a dietary supplement for astronauts on space missions. Spirulina, food for infinity and beyond. This is KCBX Public Radio for the Central Coast. I'm Father Ian, and I'm playing with food.
This is Issues and Ideas on KCBX Public Radio for the Central Coast. Up next is the Lonely Goat Cafe. My guest today is poet and activist Diane Sousa. She's the author of 4 books of poetry. Her poems have appeared in numerous journals, including The Prairie Schooner, The Banyan Review, and Kelp Journal, among others. She has been nominated for 2 Pushcart Prizes. She is a San Luis Obispo Poet Laureate Emeritus and the poet for all 5 years of the San Luis Obispo Women's March. Her most recent book is Borracha Dreamland. Welcome, Diane.
Thank you, Meher. It's great to be here.
So I'm going to start by mentioning that in one of your emails to me, you wrote, "I should let you know that my father immigrated from the Azores Islands and my mother's parents immigrated from Mexico. I'm a child of the trade routes, but I am not an immigrant." That in itself sounds like poetry to me.
Thank you.
But what does the word immigrant mean to you?
In a place like the United States, where everyone is an immigrant except for the indigenous people, I think it means that there are people around the world who are escaping poverty, escaping terror. And in the beginning, they came to America to live this dream that we put out there. America is a dreamland, which I talk about in my book, but it hasn't been that way. And being the daughter of immigrants, it meant, because I was hearing 2 different languages along with English, a third. So it meant that the world held all this possibility, that languages were magic and a way into other cultures. But I think that the idea of immigrant, what the word means to me, is a traveler to a different land where you can live and be and experience who you really are. Now, in America, I have always felt different because my parents were so different from the other parents on my block.
I loved your essay, "Working Retail Drunk." I have so many favorite lines, but I'm going to read this one. It starts with this, quote, "I am too old to work retail, and I know it will destroy me quicker than my missing tooth. But the ocean suggests I drink more and stop worrying. She will devour me first. I know this because I love the ocean every day, unrequited. And she tells me how small I am, how fragile, how she will break my teeth and bones to bits like ocean glass. Only not as pretty, not as moon-tinged." Wow. And I started thinking about writing and making money and how those feel like diametrically opposite things. So, Diane, can you share your thoughts on writing and working, but working in a capitalistic society? Does one write poetry or does one do a course on AI?
No, one does not do a course on AI. AI is out to kill us and rot our brains. You know, when I was in college, I got my degree in English, and then I thought, well, I'll be a teacher and I can write during the summer. But you know, if I wanted to be a great teacher, I would give that all of my time. And I knew that one just can't write in the summer because summer has too many offerings. You know, it's sunny and warm and the water's warm. So I decided, which was a terrible idea, to just work basically terrible jobs so that it would not interfere with my writing. And unfortunately, my writing style that I am made to do is poetry, which really doesn't pay very much, maybe $48 every 6 months. I don't know. But yeah, it is absolutely capitalism's fault. You know, in Ireland, they subsidize their poets and their artists. America, maybe it's made for a grand poetry like Whitman and Bob Dylan and Joni Mitchell and all the great poets, Theodore Rothke, but it isn't for your everyday people unless you go into academics. And I didn't want to become an academic because I think it would hurt the freeness of my writing. I mean, nothing against academics. I love my academic friends, but I think that it would have hurt me. I think that it would have weighed on my poetry because when I'm writing, I am completely free and there's no expectations and I don't have to publish. I don't have to do anything. So work stupid jobs and write as much poetry as I can.
You are Portuguese American. I read some of your poems and it feels like you have a strong connection to the sea. Does it serve as an important connection to your Portuguese roots, or can you share what the experience is like for you when you may perhaps be feeling alienated or isolated and trying to connect with your ancestors or a community?
Absolutely. So I have always, as long as I can remember, what my family did as a family was go to the ocean. My father, you know, the Azores is 1,000 miles out at sea. And my mother also loved the beach and the ocean. And we would go clam digging down in Long Beach. And also I learned to surf. And surfing is a whole another community. My whole family surfs. But just to be in the ocean, you are so small, and the ocean is such a power. And sometimes it's almost like she accepts you, and other times it's like she's just gonna spit you out. Just get out of here. You cannot take my power today. You cannot withstand my power today. But if ever there is a cure for loneliness, it is absolutely the ocean, because you are completely immersed. She cradles you. She rocks you. And yeah, there's no substitute. I was just talking to a friend the other day and we were both kind of ailing. And I said, well, you know, I went and dipped in, got the healing. So yeah, always mother ocean.
I'm actually scared of the sea, but I love looking at it. I love looking at it with longing. Like, can you not drown me? Then I will go in. But because I'm from a landlocked place here.
You're smart to be afraid of the ocean. She will drown you. But you should at least put your feet in. Yeah. I used to teach surfing with some friends, and there were women. We would hold their hands. Some of them, we had to hold their hands and take them into the ocean and just stay with them until their fear subsided. You know, they wanted to be there, but, you know, that fear is profound and for a good reason.
Let's talk about your most recent book, Borracha Dreamland. And also, can you read something from us?
I would be happy to. Yeah, it just came out right before Christmas, and it was published by Serpent's Tongue Press in Ventura in conjunction with the Ventura Poetry Festival Arts Council, because they wanted me to be the keynote poet at their festival, and I couldn't be paid if I didn't have a new book out. So they said, well, let's just publish a book for you. And I said, okay. Aww. And Borracha, I realized, you know, that's the feminine in Spanish. It's the feminine of drunkard. And I think I've always, going back to what it means to be an immigrant or how it makes me feel, I've always felt a little drunk in America. Like, I didn't quite understand the mores, and my father certainly seemed drunk all the time, but he wasn't. He was just from another. He was from an island 1,000 miles out at sea and did not know how to really, you know, fit in, which was hilarious and fun and embarrassing for me. But I will read a poem that deals with being an immigrant. This one is about my grandmother, Josefina Ramos. She came from the Michoacan, and she and my grandfather, I don't know how they got here. I just know they would not get here now. So it's called Josefina from the Michoacan. Isn't the October sky made of satin? Don't the curves of the dead show through? A soft contour of elbow bends along the border of a cloud. It must belong to my grandmother, Josefina from the Michoacan. Josefina from the Michoacan made flour tortillas every single day, 20 times on Sunday. Her hands fluttered over the dough till birds flew. Not doves, dark birds, small and swift, sharp-beaked. They filled the kitchen, flittering along the rim of her cast-iron pan. She fried them in bacon fat. If I talk about you, Josefina, will you remember me? You had so many grandchildren. I know you liked the boys better. They were easy. They took your hugs and went outside. I went out too, but snuck back in, hid snail shells and snapdragons in your bed. Come the drafty edge of every December, I vandalized your nativity set, chipped the holy pout from baby Jesus, put his mother and her donkey in my pockets and ran. You came after me, cursing in a language crocheted with flames. It scared me, Josefina. It thrilled me. Josefina, I grew up to speak English like a machete, like a curandera, like a locksmith. I know word to open the mouth of every domestic god. I can make them say whatever I need to hear. I can make them cry. For this, I thank you. Josefina, you crossed into this language when it was mean. It is meaner now. It is incendiary, but does not thrill. Burns, but does not cleanse. Cuts, but does not cure. Josefina from the Michoacan, you wouldn't make it here today. They wouldn't even let you try. They would never let you speak. Josefina, forget about me. Stay where you are, if you are, or come back. Yes, come back. Come as a bird, dark of feather, small and swift. October's border is made of satin. Fly through it, but don't come back alone. Bring a flock. Fly down with blazing songs and sharpened beaks. And if you are not caught, not caged, Josefina from the Michoacan, I will weave you a nest woven from the pillowy mouths of snapdragons. And as you nod in sleep, sweetly will I sing, O Josefina from the Michoacan, O mi abuela, I am so sorry.
Wow. The last line really got me.
Oh, thank you.
And how important for the times that we are in. Yeah, and it's interesting that you're speaking to somebody who, even though they're so far away from you, like, you're so intimately connected to them. I feel that way about my grandmother too. Thank you for sharing that, Diane.
Oh, you're welcome. And, you know, we are connected to, especially the women, all the women in our lineage, as far back as we can remember, even further back, that knowledge passes on, that wisdom, and we can tap into it. I think. I try.
If you're just joining us, this is Issues and Ideas, and I'm Meher Ali, talking to poet and activist Diane Sousa. This is a question. What does loneliness mean to you?
I think just by, well, A, coming from three different worlds, the Portuguese, the Mexican, and American, that is fun. But it can get lonely when you're interacting with people who have no clue. They have just this one place, and they know how to be in this country. And B, being a poet by its nature is a little bit lonely because you have to spend time alone to write a poem. So I have always kind of embraced that loneliness. Dylan Thomas, in my art and sullen craft, I mean, you just accept that. You sign on the dotted line. You will be lonely now and again. But, you know, to be there alone writing a poem, time goes away and you're not really here and you're just in a different space. Art does that. That's why it's so great. Art, I think, is the antidote to loneliness. It's the cause, one of the causes and one of the antidotes. And you just have to accept that.
Do you think loneliness is necessarily like a negative experience?
No, I don't. I think, you know, when you're creating, when you're painting or writing, you're not really lonely. So I think I misspoke there. You're not really lonely. You just have to be alone, which is different than loneliness. I think true loneliness is a lack of community and a lack of being able to feel love in your life. And I have not experienced that. I am fortunate to have so many people that I love and so many people who I am confident love me back. So to be that kind of lonely is a horrible isolation, I think, that humans are not made for.
In one of your interviews, you mentioned that you write a poem and then you record it and then you listen to it. I'm going to be doing that. So that was a great tip for me. But how do poems come to you?
I do not know. You know, I just wait. I have a journal that I write in, not every day, but fairly often. I probably have a stack of 20-some of them now. But I just wait until a line or an image comes to me. And then I have no idea where it's going, but I feel absolutely compelled to go and write it down. Because I think if I don't write it, because it's out there in the consciousness, and I heard it, and I'm going to write it down. If I don't write it down, someone else will, and then I'll probably get mad because they didn't do as good a job with it as I thought I could do. So I never force it. The poet Rilke said, you know, a poem has to rise up through the blood. You cannot force it. And I never force it. And I never know what I'm writing about until I'm almost done. Usually I'm just following the thread of the line or the image.
What inspires you, or do you look for inspiration in some things?
I don't consciously look for inspiration. I think the world is such a large and magical place, and nature is so profound, and I don't look for it, but I keep my mind open to it. I keep my eyes open. I think, you know, writing, and I'm also a terrible painter, but I paint anyway. I think that teaches you to really look at things. And if you look at things and you keep your mind as open as possible, things will creep in and then you will turn them into your art. I'm never consciously seeking. Only one time have I tried to write a poem, you know, to fit in a journal, and that made me feel stupid and dirty. That's not my voice. I think it's so important to let your voice develop in the way that it will, you know, alone. Yeah, you've got to develop your voice and let it be, and then respect it. Respect where it's going to go.
So I loved your references to the sea and was inspired to write a poem. And I wanted to read it to you, if that's okay with you.
Oh, that's awesome. Yes, of course.
So it's called Being an American. Being an American means apportioning blame, saying sorry and but in the same sentence, It means living about 5 miles from the sea and not being able to afford to travel there because no car. It means going for long walks across the train tracks, listening to Kendrick Lamar, staring at a sun I cannot capture, and a natural beauty that is too stark, unhidden by dust. It means getting used to no sound, like I'm constantly wearing earmuffs. It means smiling at dogs I don't know and paying $6 for a cappuccino. So much of being an American is not being so many other things, but I can't really recall what these things are. Maybe being an American means letting go of memory. Maybe it means living my life through TV characters, leaving just enough emotion to course through me that it keeps me alive but doesn't overpower me. I must not speak too loudly. I must not clown around. I long to see the sea and sit by the beach too, but I'll have to first walk through mall outlets, and I know I'll get lost and then find myself waiting for a bus home in that bright sun, my mouth open, teeth out, smiling politely.
Oh, I love that, Mayor. That's beautiful. It's so apt. That is what it is to be American. Smiling at dogs you don't know. 5 miles from the beach, but you don't have a car. Walking around like you're wearing earmuffs. My God, that's totally true. Thank you for sharing it with me.
Thank you.
Just to conclude our interview, I wanted to ask if you could read another poem of yours.
Sure, I'd be happy to. The book is broken up into three sections of two nightmares and one lucid dream. Very first poem in the book is called Party Dress, Nightmare Number One, and it starts with a epigram from Gloria Steinem. There are 6 million female lives lost in the world every year simply because they are female. Gloria Steinem, maybe you know, she was a Playboy bunny, and that's the dress I'm referring to. Party dress, nightmare number one. I wake with sorrow and a broken scream trapped in my bones. Mama, I was invited to a party. At the party, they played a game. The rules were this. All the women were pinned down and sewn into identical dresses. Some of us smiled, but it hurt. Ensnared in identical dresses, we were posed for pictures in front of a wall lined with whitewashed flags and obscene Boy Scouts. The dress was electric, eat this and die, pink, laced with flesh-barbed metallic threads, a heart-shaped peekaboo bodice, and a goddamn bunny tail. You could wear this dress in the desert, Mama, and burst like a blushing human Hindenburg. You could wear it in an elevator and conduct terrifying social experiments. You could wear it to time travel and be forced to dance on stage or be burned as a witch. Oh, Mama, I'm glad you weren't there, but I know you wore this kind of dress too. Maybe it didn't have a tail, but it bound you just the same.
I love how your poems are like conversations, either between people or between you and somebody else. And it's like you're in your mind, you're having this conversation and you're sharing both the things that occur to you, but also like what the other person may say or is saying.
Yeah, maybe. I mean, it's my conversation with the world. How I think about my poetry is that we're here on this plane and life wants a report. So this is my report back to life, to the luminous consciousness, wherever we came from. These are my reports and I have to make them. So I think that's who the conversation is with.
Thank you so much, Diane, for joining us at the Lonely Goat Cafe.
Thank you, Meher. It was wonderful meeting you and hearing your poetry. And I can't wait to meet you in person and take you to the ocean. I have a car. Yes. Oh.
That was poet and activist Diane Sousa speaking with me, Meher Ali, on the Lonely Goat Cafe for Issues and Ideas. This is KCBX Public Radio for the Central Coast. Next, a story about the Central Coast from the archives of the California Report. A composer and winemaker from Edna Valley speaks with reporter Benjamin Perper about creating music that draws on the sounds of a vineyard.
It's a foggy morning at a small, family-owned winery called Claiborne and Churchill in San Luis Obispo's Edna Valley, one of the Central Coast's most iconic wine destinations. It's 8 a.m. before anyone shows up to the winery, and for composer and winemaker Brooke Monroe, that's the perfect time to tune in to the sounds of the vineyard.
This is our Riesling vineyard here, and if we get quiet...
He's standing perfectly still, listening to a chorus of birds and insects.
You know, there's an ecosystem out there that's quite fascinating.
This is what Brooke spent many months doing, walking through this vineyard and recording these sounds. He's been a manager at Claiborne and Churchill for more than 15 years, so he knows this vineyard intimately. He's also a lifelong musician. He's toured with a rock band called The Mighty Fine and scored several indie films. In 2021, he set out to create his first solo project, one that combined his love of winemaking with his love of music.
It's a wild concept, turning wine into music, but to me, I felt like it had to be done because I am in a very unique situation. I don't know many composers who are also like full-time in the wine industry.
Over the course of 2 years and two harvests, he created his debut solo album, Harvest in 12 Parts.
The artistry of winemaking and music making are quite similar. There's a lot of inputs and a lot of variables that are controlled and some that are not controlled, but at the end of the day, whether it's sipping a glass of wine or putting headphones on and taking a listen to something, you know, there's so much that goes into that.
Creating music out of vineyard sounds required a unique approach. Brooke had to find sounds he could record, put into his music software, and manipulate. One day, he was walking through the grapevines, and the trellis wire supporting them gave him an idea.
I'd pull on this wire, and the wire would screech against the rust here, and a really ear-piercing sound. And it sounded horrible, but there was a fundamental pitch to it. I recorded it on my phone, but rather than recording in real time, I recorded it in slow motion. And in doing so, all that playback, because it slows down, it also pitches down. And so now when it pitches down two or three octaves, now you have a fundamental tone that actually has this cool, like, simple, compelling sound that it's actually the first tone that you hear on the first track, Jubileum.
But as you can hear, that trellis wire tone isn't the only sound.
I blended that in with birds from the vineyard, but those birds that you hear in there, I manipulated in such a way that you know that they're birds, but I definitely processed them in such a way that, like, I wanted to evoke this sense of like, okay, we're gonna start this journey and we're gonna start getting in. And then like cello comes in.
That combination of traditional instruments and digitally processed vineyard sounds makes up most of the album. But it's often hard to tell the difference between the two. That's because Brooke basically made those sounds into instruments. He recorded things like the sound of wine glasses, manipulated them into a single pitch, and then mapped that pitch onto a virtual keyboard, meaning he could now play that sound like he would a piano. Inside the tasting room, he grabs a wine glass to demonstrate.
So I would, with a field recorder and with a mallet, soft mallet. And record that sound. And then, you know, through some digital processing, I could then create this really cool sound where it sounded almost like a high-end mallet or xylophone. Almost like a toy piano.
Harvest in 12 Parts is full of this kind of experimentation. Brooke takes me to a giant metal storage tank, opens it up, and does this.
That's cool.
Brooke recorded a friend singing into the tank to create the song Becoming. He plays it for me on his phone.
That's all Kate's voice.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
There's a reason Harvest in 12 Parts took Brooke 2 years to create. It isn't easy making any album. Making an album like this is a whole nother level. Capturing the sounds, manipulating them, composing the music, recording the instruments, mixing, mastering, mostly by himself, took a lot of work and time. That's on top of his job at the winery. Brooke says it's unlike anything he's ever done, and it's changed how he sees himself creatively.
You know, I've always considered myself a musician, a composer. I never really saw myself as a quote-unquote artist until I finished Harvest in 12 Parts. And then I felt like, okay, if someone wants to lump me in that category, like, oh, he's an artist, then I wouldn't be able to deny it at that point.
Brooke Monroe says he hopes Harvest in 12 Parts inspires others to embrace experimentation in music and wine.
I know if someone else took their experiences into the vineyard and into the cellar and into the barrel room and they crafted something musically or artistically, that it would be beautiful. And it wouldn't sound like me, it would sound like them. And music and wine, the end result is always going to be very much an extension of the person who created it.
That was reporter Benjamin Perper's story on composer and winemaker Brooke Monroe. You've been listening to Issues and Ideas on KCBX, public radio for the Central Coast. Gary Eister composed our theme music. A special thanks to all our guests and contributors this week. I'm Meher Ali. Join us each Monday from 1 to 2 in the afternoon for more local stories. You can head to our website to learn more about what you heard today or to listen to past segments at kcbx.org.